All across America and around the world, this is Veterans Radio.
This is Veterans Radio.
And now, your host for today's program, Dale Thronberry.
Hey, welcome to Veterans Radio. My name is Dale Thronberry, CW2 type helicopter pilot in Vietnam in 1969. Welcome to our program. I'm really excited. We've got some great guests on. We're going to be talking with an author of a book called Damn the Valley, William Yeske. This is a heavy book. Not heavy by size. It's just heavy. It's an emotional story. So I'm excited to talk with Will about that. We've got another segment on later on in the program where we're going to be talking to Scott Lopez. And Scott is a member of the NVBDC, which is the National Veterans Business Development Council. And he's going to be talking about his business and his connection with NVBDC. Also, toward the end of the program, we're going to be playing a little tribute to Toby Keith, who's many of you know, is a musician, country western musician who passed away earlier this month. True patriot. And so we're going to play one of his songs at the end of the program and kind of say goodbye to him. Well, before we get to that, we got to thank our sponsors. We can't do this program without them. So I want to make sure that we thank Legal Help for Veterans. Legal Help for Veterans specializes in veterans disability claims. You can give Legal Help for Veterans a call at 800-693-4800. The National Veterans Business Development Council, better known as NVBDC, is the nation's leading third-party authority for the certification of veteran-owned businesses. For more information, you can go to their website, that's nvbdc.org, or give them a call at 888-237-8433. Just a quick reminder, if you are a veteran-owned business or a disabled veteran-owned business and you want to do business with the federal government and many corporations, you need to be certified that you are an actual veteran-owned business. And these are the guys that can help you out. NVBDC.org. The Charles S. Kettles VA Medical Center here in Ann Arbor, Michigan. For more information about them, you can go to va.gov/AnnArborHealthcare. We also want to make sure that we don't forget our local veterans organizations for their longtime support. They've been with us ever since 2003, and we wouldn't have ever been able to get the program off the ground without their support. So this is the Irwin Pretz Corps and American Post 46 and the Charles S. Kettles Vietnam Veterans of America Chapter 310, both of Ann Arbor, Michigan. As I mentioned, we've been doing this now for about 20 years, and we are hoping that we can keep going for another 20 years. That will only make me in my late 90s. I don't know if I'm going to do that or not. But we do need your support. So if you could help us out, we'd greatly appreciate it. $20 for 20 years. Go to our website, veteransradio.org. Click on the donate button. Whatever you feel that you can afford would be greatly appreciated. Really, thank you. If you have a company that is interested in sponsoring Veterans Radio, please shoot me an email at dale@veteransradio.org, and I will get back to you as soon as possible. So thank you very much for all of your support. Everybody out there, we love doing this, and we love that you like what we're doing and that you support us with your contributions to the program. All right, so let me get right into the show today. My guest that I'm introducing is William Yeske, and his book is Damn the Valley. And it's a story of a 1st Platoon Bravo Company, 2nd of the 58th, I don't even know what all these things are anymore, B-O-8-R, of the 82nd Airborne in the Argandab River Valley in Afghanistan. Will, welcome to Veterans Radio.
Dale, it's great to be here.
I'll tell you, this book really knocked my socks off when I was reading this thing. It's a really intense story about enlisted personnel more than anything else. You only have a few comments in there about commanding officers and so forth, but this is the story of enlisted folks.
Yeah, I tried to, I know there's been so many different ways that people have, you know, what they've gleaned from the book, but yes, I wanted to keep this one from the ground up, where normally you'll get a lot of the books out either these days. It seems to be, you know, a myriad of special operations books, which is good and everything, you know, and then a lot of the other stuff you get a lot of the books out there that are written from the officer's perspective, whether it be that general level officer to where, you know, a lot of this might be written either from accounts or, you know, historical things, the AERs they bring in and whatnot. So it's a little different when you get a view from the guys on the ground, especially just a private at the time, you know, going through what's essentially, man, what was essentially a really rough time in Afghanistan at that time.
Yeah. And let's go there. When, as I mentioned, we're talking with William Yeske, better known as Will. And Will, you joined the volunteer army at the age of 26. What kept you?
That was, so I was actually looking into the Marines at 18, and, you know, we weren't at war at the time, and my parents had kind of talked me out of it. You know, they were like, hey, look, go the college route, and then from there, you know, if you still want to join up, you have our full blessing to go in as an officer. And of course, that sounded pretty good to me. Of course, all they were doing was running a PSYOP campaign because they knew I was going to get distracted and in college and whatnot, the type of person I was at the time. And, you know, it just ended up to where I was at a point in my life to, you know, there was some things going on to where I had to make some decisions, and I decided to hit the reset button, and I wanted to join up and do some time in the service as sort of the hard reset. It was something I always wanted to do. It was something that I always had that purpose instilled in me to do something greater than myself. And that's kind of what led me to look at that more seriously and go, you know what, if I'm going to do it, I don't want to regret not going that route. So let's just go and let's go be the best that I can, you know, and do the best that I can, especially while we were in a time of war, you know.
So you're from a small town in Connecticut, is that right?
Very small town, very like 8,000 people strong.
Okay. And so you went in, and you didn't just go in and just basically go through basic training. Did you go in with a specific purpose of getting involved with special forces or airborne, or what were your thoughts?
At the time when I signed up, it was 2008 when I actually went into the service, and I kind of could feel that Afghanistan was winding down. And, I mean, little did I know everything at the time, but I wanted a way into the fight and was like, hey, what's the best way to do that? Should I, you know, be going back to look at the Marines? What are my options here? And really looked at the best way to go is to sign up for the 18 X-ray program, which was civilian to Green Beret. You still have to go through the entire pipeline, just like everybody else does, but they have a preparatory class in between that. Surprisingly, a lot of the guys that take the SOPC course, which is Special Operations Preparatory and Conditioning, they end up pretty strong. You know, they're some of the stronger out of the lot to where they lean on the NCOs and some of the E4s and stuff that have been in the Army going through that particular course for the experience. So it's almost a little bit of a meshing there. But I ended up doing, you know, your basic training pipeline into airborne school, because anybody that's looking at going special operations, they have to go through airborne. And I've talked to quite a few people about the psychology behind that end, you know, in where it, quite honestly, the airborne is a little different than a lot of the other soldiers that you'll find out there. And it doesn't really have to do with the fact, you know, hey, I jump out of perfectly good airplanes, but it's that repeated exposure to higher adrenaline events to where you're actually, your body's learning to deal with cortisol spikes. So when that adrenaline starts going, when a firefight or a gunfight's going on, and you really need to be thinking about what's happening, you're already sort of conditioned. You've already had a leg up on other people that are out there in that way. You've been exposed to that. So your body has a quicker regulation time. But yeah, I went through airborne school. Got hurt in SOPC, but still completed that portion, but then ended up in med hold. And the sergeant major came through and cut everybody from the program, you know, that was sitting in medical hold just all at once. I was like, hey, I've not even been here a week. Like, there's doesn't matter. You're out of here, you know? And a lot of us found ourselves in the 82nd, and within a year's time, you know, overseas, and 4th Brigade got sent to Afghanistan.
How did you feel about that? You know, I know you, you know, you sound as though you were really kind of excited to get, you know, to get deployed and, you know, go down range and actually see what this whole thing is all about.
And, well, and absolutely.
If you had the strength to do it.
Yeah, no, I knew I had the strength to do it and get out there. I mean, our command team at 4th Brigade in the 82nd there, and that 2 Fury was awesome. I mean, we were, and it still is a great unit. It was a lot of times they're the whipping boys of the 82nd, and they seem to get a lot more of the crap. But the thing is it's almost like they're made for that wartime type of mentality that they need to be. They're a little bit of a wild card there, you know, some of them and stuff, but they're everything that airborne should be.
Ooh-ah, right?
Right.
So, all right. So you end up, you know, you're getting to deployed. When did you go to Afghanistan?
So that was, well, I got to the unit in December of 2008. And then, you know, by September 2009, we're leaving. So we were actually slated for Iraq. So a lot of our train up was a lot of that kinetic CQB building to building type of things that you'll see, because mm-hmm. that's what we were headed into. So when we got the orders that came down, hey, you're going to be part of the surge into Afghanistan, and executive orders were actually signed by President Obama to switch our deployment. Hey, you know, they're the next ones out. They're going to Afghanistan instead. We sort of, I for one was sort of relieved. I was like, oh, cool. No more of this urban fight type thing. We'll have a little bit more standoff. And little did I know the situation we were heading into. I mean, so the beginning of the deployment was sort of your typical type. You know, it was Helmand Province, and we had gotten word from the people who went on Advon party, so the advance party that went over there. They were like, hey, we've already been involved in some firefights, but this is great. This is going to be awesome. It's been a heck of a time. It's everything that we've looked forward to. And we were stoked. And then we got over there, and it was very much that hurry up and wait type scene that you see. And you're like, what happened? Did you guys just take care of all the bad guys right in the beginning? And, you know, really it was essentially driving up and down the highway until that first firefight that we got into on Halloween back in 2009. So, you know, up until that point, again, it was a lot of just driving dusty highways, working hand in hand with Afghan police. But let's face it, a lot of times it was just sitting around waiting for something to happen, which nothing ever did.
Yeah, that was an element. But you then you moved.
Then we moved.
So the driving up and down the roads that you're talking about, were you just acting as escorts for convoys, or what were you doing?
No, so a lot of that had to do with the advise and assist mission that we ended up picking up to advise and assist the Afghan National Police. So there's checkpoints and stuff up and down all of these highways. And we would basically roll down the highway, hit the checkpoint. There might be a training mission that day where, you know, you might have a company or two and stuff that you're working with. And that was the beginning. So during that time, that was where a lot of the other more experienced guys, they were doing all the training, and we were sitting back in the trucks most of the day doing nothing, essentially like, hey man, why are we out here? We're just guarding a bunch of stuff, priorities of work, mm-hmm. you know? And, again, a lot of waiting around.
When did you get sent out into the valley?
So the Argandab came when, you know, we had our command team there for battalion. They kept, you know, hammering at the time, the ISAF commander. So the commander over that part of the theater was General Stanley McChrystal. And our battalion commander had been his aide at one point or part of his team somewhere. So they were on terms, and he basically sent him something that, hey, I got a bunch of hungry paratroopers who are doing nothing in Helmand Province. You know, I can't get him into Marjo, which is what he was trying to do originally. What can we do here? Do you have anything? And that's when we, you know, he was like, oh yeah, I've got something for you. And that's where we ended up replacing 117 strikers out of Fort Lewis, Washington. And you can actually look up, there's some news articles and stuff. I think it's Colonel Harry Tunnell's Ill-Fated Striker Brigade. You can look up. And man, those guys, when we got there to replace them, you could just tell. You know, you could look at these guys when we were doing our side-by-side left seat, right seat missions to kind of show us the area we were taking over. These guys were beat, you know, and one of the guys before we even left, he kind of, you know, he was a lower enlist. He was another private at the time and stuff. And I kind of asked him like, hey man, like what's this place all about and stuff. And he's like, man, we haven't even left the wire in X amount of time. You know, the last month or so, he's like, this place is hell. And, you know, we, even during that side-by-side patrol into the valley, that first look of everything, we had a Kiowa mission. So these smaller helicopters come by and they called in fire on two guys that were just digging in the riverbed. You know, we all kind of looked at each other and we're like, hey, you know, it's not our area of operations, but what the heck was that? You know, and they kind of looked at us and were like, oh no, man, they're digging in landmines. This has been an issue before. In a riverbed?
Can you describe, you know, we've all read the stories, we've seen the news and everything like that about Afghanistan, but can you describe your AO, your area of operation and what it was like? And, you know, like the temperatures and so forth. I don't think many of us are really, really aware of the weather in Afghanistan, yeah. Plus the terrain.
So where you look at some of the stuff from Helmand Province, where you have that typical Lawrence of Arabia type, you look at it and you're like dusty, arid desert region. You can see for miles. And then you turn to the Argandab. And you have every bit of environment known to man there, between the mountains in the distance that just spanned across here to where we have guys, where we put them up on an observation point. There was two specific ones. There was OP-160 and 165. And we would man 165. And we would have, you know, some sniper rifles up there and a clue and a javelin. And everything, as well as thermals and whatnot. So they would provide overwatch. But in bringing them up there and going up to that, you know, that little cave and that point on the summit to where they would sit for, you know, we'd put four or five guys up there for about 5 days at a time. When they were up at that height, you'd see helicopters underneath you. And you were like, whoa, what's going on? And they're like, hey, they're at max altitude. I think it was only Chinooks were the only ones that could actually fly over the mountain passes. You know, so you go from that huge mountain down into this valley to where there's just sectioned off farmer fields and different compounds and stuff, 8 to 10 foot walls. And you'd have to cross, you know, 10 to 20 of them, depending on your length of control of patrol every time. Springtime was muddy, so either you're slipping around or slopping through mud, you know, irrigation systems. Really a lot. It was just surreal because you have to where they're using ancient farming techniques and whatnot, but sometimes they're crop sharing and they're pumping these fields full from the river, but using modern equipment. So it's just crazy to see this mesh of what we ended up dubbing, you know, it's just a very ingenious mess of methods.
Well, you mentioned in the book a number of times the different time periods. You know, like if you're, you know, you're coming from 21st century America to,
yeah,
you know, 1000 AD in Afghanistan, and that, you know, habits and cleanliness and sanitation and, you know, are kind of all over the place.
Yeah, and there's a shepherd coming by with his livestock, but he's wearing Adidas slides and a G-Shock watch. And you're like, this is the most mind-blowing, strange thing here.
I can only imagine, you know, and it had to be culture shock for probably both sides.
Oh, I'm sure. Just the interaction though in between, they had some interaction and stuff with Americans, but a lot of times it just depended. It depended who the guys were. Some of them wanted nothing to do with sitting down with the Afghans, and other guys were like, yeah, man, let's buy the, you know, we'll buy the interpreters some lunch today, because for $5, you get a stack of foot bread that was maybe 20 non deep, you know, and what it would feed the interpreters for a week's time. You get some of our guys in there and it's gone immediately. But, you know, but we'd occasionally buy for them and sit down and have a meal and stuff with them. And as well as I always made it a point to converse with some of the local contractors or people that we would have pass through. And there's even an instance to where that fact may have even ended up saving some lives.
Could you explain that a little bit more?
Yeah, sure. That's the point to where they started having these local work parties that they would use on the compound. I mean, there was so much work to be done within base improvement on Cop Ware, which was where we originally ended up when we went into the Argandab. We established it basically. So this is in a farm field. They had to bring in rocks, you know, because everything was sinking down into the mud. They had to fill the HESCO barriers. So, I mean, there was heavy equipment that needed to be brought in for that. There was just a multitude of different things. And, you know, we had to bring a guard out there to kind of watch these guys and everything. So I would always make it a point to either share a smoke with them or, you know, have a limited conversation and stuff with them, but always say something to them one way or another. Later on in deployment, when I was out of Cop Johnston, we were down by one of the bazaars, and from across the way, they had a nickname for me because of the camel on my cigarettes. So Whoosh in Pashtun is camel. So I hear this, "Hey, Whoosh," from, you know, across the way. And it was one of the guys that I had talked to and was like, "Oh, hey," kind of call him over. And, you know, again, in a limited and broken conversation, he's basically like, "Oh, you guys are going down this way?" And he's like, "Ah, I wouldn't go down that way today if I were you." You know, "What do you mean?" And I said something to the squad leader about it, which was Sergeant Ackers at the time. And we, of course, we did go that way. We just went into a bounding overwatch to where we were really watching everything around us. We had other guys, you know, checking us as that element moves forward and vice versa. Maybe just due to that diligence or that extra oversight, you know, it's very possible that guy might have just saved us from an ambush.
Right. It sounded like
you never quite know.
Right. It sounded like he was warning you.
Yeah. Yeah.
About something. Now, we're talking with Will Yeske. His book is entitled Damn the Valley, about his experiences in Afghanistan. And, you know, you mentioned these. I'm trying to, you know, include as many parts of our audience as I can.
There's so many stories in here.
Oh, I know. But you're talking about these forward observation. Well, I guess they weren't called that then, but you know, these COPs, the combat outposts that you went out to, and you had to build from nothing.
Mm-hmm. So that has to do with size. Is like, so there's actually a whole thing to where you have your main operating bases, like Kandahar Airfield, mm-hmm. and then some of your forward FOB. So forward operating base, which is like FOB Walton was mentioned, to where we refitted. And it was a larger one. They had a flight line where helicopters could come in and out and stuff, but not an actual airfield, you know, and then that breaks it down to these combat outposts. So that one that we established, we literally took that area by force, which means we just rolled in and overnight it's like, "Hey, this is now our spot," you know, and push out security and bring in everything. And, you know, basically, Cop Ware was usually plus or minus about 100 people at any time. And then it broke down to where later on in the deployment, you know, 2nd Platoon was originally over at Cop Johnston, but we replaced 2nd Platoon at Cop Johnston, and 2nd Platoon was pushed out to an area of a town called Diakashe. And 3rd Platoon stayed back at Cop Ware. And it was really because the entire area was so saturated, you know, so we ended up on at one time we were only 28 guys on Cop Johnston, but really it was anywhere from 34 to 28 guys. It was, we operated independently as platoons, and you had these smaller patrols of maybe 12 men out as a, you know, operating as a squad or a squad plus with somebody from weapons, you know, and whatnot, depending on what exactly your mission was. So very small elements just because of the amount of, you know, enemy within that territory and the limited movement just due to the amount of landmines and stuff that were put in.
This is where I was in trouble reading continually with the your exposure to the landmines and IEDs that were, you know, not only built into the road every 200 feet or so, but also they were built into the buildings. And can you tell us a little bit about that adventure?
Yeah, sure.
That you had?
I mean, it was definitely an adventure, that's for sure. It's so, I know the one that you're referring to in particular is kind of one of the more harder to read chapters in the book, and it has to do with sort of the techniques that the enemy would use. They were really masters of their craft, the team that would emplace these landmines and explosives. And these guys would use anything from to where the footpaths would have like a toe popper type mine to where there wasn't enough metal in it for our mine detectors to pick up. It was just a very trace small, maybe something the size of a safety pin. And that smaller charge would initiate a larger charge that you could put remotely somewhere else. So this particular one was a landmine to where we came in and we flowed into this compound, and I had literally stepped over this area maybe 30 seconds prior. And the rest of the squad is coming in, and one of the guys stepped on the initiator charge and ended up blowing up the main charge in the wall, which was right underneath where Specialist Johnston was. And quite honestly, in looking at some of this stuff, and who really knows for sure, but quite honestly, I think the fact that Johnston being directly over where that mine was placed and took the brunt of that explosive charge is what ended up saving the squad, because that landmine was ended up, that was really meant to be a squad killer. So just the different techniques that they would use and the different ways that they would, you had to constantly adapt out there. It's where we were talking before in Vietnam, where guys would be walking in the footsteps of others. And that's where, you know, we had to move from moving in a wedge through areas to collapsing down into a single file for that very reason, minimizing the amount of ground that we were putting over, because that's what the fight essentially was.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And you guys were exposed to this every day. Every day. That's why, you know, and your unit had so many casualties. I mean, not necessarily, you know, that many. It's cavalier of me. Not that many killed.
Oh, no.
But
I know what you mean.
So many damaged.
Yeah. And when you start to spread out across, you know, as through researching the book and, you know, talking to other people, I mention it in here that when we went to leave, you know, and going to talk to the guys over at the Pedro hangar, so the medevac guys that were pulling us out, you know, they would usually be there. So it was Air Force PJs. And I want to say it was Pedro 54 and 66 that were the two that were pulling us in and out. And finding out things like Pedro 66 was one of the ones that got shot down, you know, over that time when we were there. And finding out just the sheer scope of how many people were affected, it was just absolutely mind-blowing. You know, and really just a heavy thing when you start going through it and finding out how many people were affected from this thing. Even the social media campaigns and stuff, when people look across, I mean, we've got things, you know, it goes from Instagram, Facebook, YouTube, Reddit, but Damn the Valley book, and people are just coming out of the woodwork that are like, Argandab, I remember that place, left and right. And that specific area is a hot button topic for a lot of these guys. A lot of people that were there hold the exact same stories, you know, or at least the same sentiment. that we did.
Well, one of the things I think that's so interesting, we touched on this before we came on the air, is in this world of all these different connections with social media and so forth, is that you are able to get these stories out now instead of 30, 40 years from now. And yeah. Some of the people, you know, you've had, you know, in listening to other interviews, you had a 52% casualty rate in your platoon, approximately. So that's over half of people who were either wounded or killed.
Well, in the company, but yeah. Yeah. But
that's still a lot of baggage to carry with you when you come home.
Yeah. And really, I've kind of found that through sharing these stories, it's been good, not only for myself, but it's been good for a lot of the guys that I talk to, that peer-to-peer type support, mm-hmm. to where there happens to be a lot of veterans out there, and you hear it quite often, you know, they don't want to see a therapist, or they don't want to go to therapy. They don't understand me. They've never been through this type of stuff. Quite honestly, trauma is trauma, and they do know how to treat those responses to that stuff. But if it's the fact of somebody sharing their own story in order to start opening up to the idea of facing this sort of thing, then there's definite value in it. And I know that, again, for myself, when in writing this book, slowing down enough to be able to process everything that had happened to myself and some of the other guys ended up being a really good thing for myself. And in talking with, you know, some of the other guys that were there, the majority of the guys that were over there, and hearing these stories, but then also from one in particular hearing, you know, this has been really good for me. I feel like a burden's been lifted off of my soul because it's been so long since I've been able to talk about this sort of thing. Thank you. And that to me has meant everything.
You know, it gives you a clearer understanding of what you went through sometimes, because you block out some of the terrible things, and you're kind of asking yourself, did that really happen? And, you know, and then you talk to somebody who was there and they go, I remember when you did this. I did.
Yeah, and these stories come out of the woodwork too. Like, it's multiple times. Oh my gosh, I forgot about that. I can't believe you wrote that down. Oh my God. Like, it just, you know, and they come flooding back with things. So it is cool in that aspect too of, you know, these guys are remembering this stuff as well that they had blocked out with fond memories, you know, so that end is good to hear as well.
The book has a lot of serious and some scary parts in it, but there's also some humorous things that go on in here, you know, and you mentioned, you know, care packages from home and, you know, the sharing of the wealth when some of these things came in and, you know, one particular thing that I liked was you were, I think it's Cop Johnson, and you had some pancake mix, but you didn't have any way of cooking the pancakes.
Yeah, I did. At one point they sent out, I had asked, you know, hey, can you send me a bunch of instant Bisquick? And they did, you know, and then I had no way to cook it where we were. There was just, it was so austere of an environment. There was nothing. And then we ended up getting one of those cooking trailers, but nobody uses it to use it. No food, no freezer Connex or nothing to cook on it. So it was like we were living off MREs for most of the time. And we finally ended up getting stuff out and then getting a food source and everything. And I was able to one morning, you know, it was a particular, I think it was within the last month we were there. One morning I was able to treat the guys coming in to a stack of hotcakes. And they were just like, what in the heck? And I think I used a whole, you know, a whole package of butter that the cook had. He was furious at me, but you know what? The guys loved it. And it was just a little taste of home, I guess.
Well, I think so. You know, I don't think the military has changed that much either, because you talk in the book is Damn the Valley by William Yeske. I encourage our audience to go out and get this book, but you have the thing where you guys broke into the freezer unit and scarfed down most of the ice cream.
No. It wasn't most of the ice cream, but myself along with weapons squad commandeered a 5-gallon Ben and Jerry's that they had in there for us. And man, I don't think we've been sicker since, but it was worth every bite.
I think so. Okay. All right. We have a couple of minutes to go. I'm so happy that you survived, and I'm sure that you are too.
Absolutely.
But you've been carrying this message along with you since you got out of the service and have been helping veterans in many different ways. And I know that you are, you know, kind of a entrepreneur, marketing guru out there that's been, you know, help small businesses and so forth. Who is it or what is it that you've been involved with so much since you got out?
I mean, really, it's been that race to become, I guess, useful. You know, I went to business school after I got out, finished business school in 2.5 years, and then went forward to do some graduate classes with Columbia Business School, which I actually just finished up fairly recently, putting all that stuff to use. You know, it's through the thing with the book, but helping other people along the way, really these collaborative efforts and everything has been where I've found the most use of everything. You know, it's guys from Charlie Company. I mentioned it in the book Across the River from Us, got them a publishing deal, and they have a book next year, or early 2025, actually, by the name of Devil's Playground by Andrew Bragg coming out. There's, you know, between that, there's other stories from other guys. There's a few other authors that have helped out there, but people within Maryland, we're doing some stuff with Warrior Wad, where we're laying that mental health foundation through the physical end of things, which I found myself to be very helpful as well. And then there's Racing for Heroes, which has been phenomenal in the way of getting these groups of guys together. But the same thing is really, that's their whole thing as well, is that the physical health end of things and rolling into the mental health and creating that group around you that is that it's your community, you know, your backup and your support that a lot of us lose when we leave out of the service. That's been one of the best things about this, is reconnecting with the other guys, but then also using that and using this group of guys and going forward and moving forward together.
I think that's such an advantage that you have right now, again, with the social media and everything, is that all of you were able to maintain contact. And because, you know, you went over together, most of you came back together. And I know that there's usually a little down period before they even let you go home, which is very smart. we were home in 24 hours. You know, you're still wearing your fatigues when you leave. You know, you left Saigon and you arrive in Detroit in your fatigues. And yeah, it was kind of a strange world out there. So what is the name of your company and how can people contact you?
So No Limits Marketing Group. I mean, you can get me nolimitsmarketinggroup.com. You got William Yeske on LinkedIn, W Yeske on Twitter. And then Damn the Valley Book is basically the link tree to everything. There's links to all the social on the book end, the Amazon stuff, Barnes & Noble, where you can find the book, but also how to get in touch with me. I mean, really, honestly, the easiest way to do it would just be to go to damnthevalleybook.com and go from there.
Which is what I did.
Smart man.
Yes, I think so. All right. Well, I want to, you know, we've been talking with William Yeske. That's Yeske. The book is Damn the Valley. It's a great story, an inspiring story, a scary story. It's everything that anybody who's ever been in the military probably went through at one point or another, and puts it in context and from the enlisted man's viewpoint. And I think that's what's so important and what I found so interesting about the book. So I want to thank you so much, Will, for being on Veterans Radio. Let me know if you write another one, or let me know about the group that's coming across the river.
Absolutely. Dale, it's been real. Thank you so much for having me on, and I absolutely will.
Okay. Thank you very much, Will Yeske. All right. We're going to take a break right now for our Medal of Honor segment, and when we come back, we're going to be looking at the NVBDC organization's business of the month. So we'll be right back after this.
The Medal of Honor is the highest award for valor in combat given a member of the Armed Forces of the United States. There have been over 3,400 recipients of the nation's highest award. This is one of them.
First Lieutenant John Fox called in artillery fire on his own position. Details after this.
If you have a VA claim denied by the Board of Veterans' Appeals, contact Legal Help for Veterans at 1-800-693-4800. They're experts in handling cases before the U.S. Court of Appeals for Veterans Claims. Their number again, 1-800-693-4800.
On Christmas night in 1944, enemy soldiers in civilian clothes gradually infiltrated the town Fox and his men were in, and by early morning, the town was largely in hostile hands. An organized attack by uniformed German units began at 4 a.m. Being greatly outnumbered, most of the American forces were forced to withdraw from the town, but Fox and other members of his observer party voluntarily remained on the second floor of a house to direct defensive artillery fire. Fox reported the Germans were in the streets and attacking in strength. He then called for defensive artillery fire to slow the enemy advance. As the Germans continued to press the attack towards the area that Fox occupied, he adjusted the artillery fire closer to his position. Finally, he was warned that the next adjustment would bring the deadly artillery right on top of his position. After acknowledging the danger, Lieutenant Fox insisted that the last adjustment be fired, as this was the only way to defeat the attacking soldiers. Later, when a counterattack retook the position from the Germans, Lieutenant Fox's body was found with the bodies of approximately 100 German soldiers.
The Medal of Honor series is a production of Veterans Radio.
Military veterans touch everyone's life. I'm guessing right now you're thinking of a veteran, a close friend, relative. Maybe it's you. Even the toughest of us sometimes need help, but don't know where to turn for support. You don't need special training to help a veteran in your life. We can all help someone going through a difficult time. Learn how you can be there for veterans. Visit veteranscrisisline.net. Veteranscrisisline.net. A message from the U.S. Department of Veterans Affairs.
We want to welcome to Veterans Radio today business owner, visionary Scott Lopez. He is the driving force behind Zeepo Production Inc., better known as ZPI. We have him on today because we have a relationship with National Veteran Business Development Council, NVBDC.org, as it's better known, to spotlight companies involved with NVBDC. Which is the nation's leading third-party authority for certification of veteran-owned businesses, really of all sizes. This 501c3 nonprofit was established back in 2013, and it addresses the growing need to identify and certify both service-disabled and veteran-owned businesses for the commercial and government marketplace. NVBDC has a rigorous certification process designed to withstand the scrutiny of governmental and corporate entities in seeking to use veteran-owned businesses. So Scott Lopez and ZPI are NVBDC certified. Scott, why don't we start with this? Tell us why a nice kid from Texas went from high school to the U.S. Army to driving around A1 battle tanks.
Yeah, actually, I grew up in Southern California. I live in Austin now, but I grew up in Southern California, and I think like most combat arms soldiers or anybody in the military, I don't know, college wasn't for me, right? So it wasn't great in high school. wasn't my favorite thing. So wanted to say thanks to the country. You know, I remember being in basic training, and every day the drill sergeants get in front of you, and you know, what are you here for? And some of the guys were court ordered to be there, and some were there for just the GI Bill. And the drill sergeant got in front of me and goes, what are you here for? I was only 17 years old in basic training. He says, Lopez, why'd you join the Army? I said, just to say thanks. He said, God, that's the best answer I've ever heard. Get up here. You're our platoon leader. So I don't know. I've always just been very patriotic. That's the one reason. But didn't have a whole lot of options, I guess. But it worked out really well for me. But
well, as we're going to hear later, as you figure, life after service was great, has been great. And you're in a great position now, and you get to not only thank the country, but also recognize your Hispanic heritage. And we'll talk a little bit about that. But tell us what ZPI does.
So ZPI, actually, Zeppel Productions, Inc., and Zeppel is just Lopez backwards, right? If, you know, everyone always asks what Zeppelin, and I grew up, my best friend growing up, his name was Scott. So he was Long, I was Lopez. So since I was really young, I always been called Lopez. And then, you know, when you join the Army, no one uses the first name. So everyone just always called me Lopez. So I went with Lopez backwards to Zeppel. So Zeppel Productions, Inc., we actually produce private labels and exclusive brands of services or hardware for distribution partners or reseller partners in the IT space. So Ingram Micro, Tech Data, Synnex, D&H, these are all big, gigantic computer distributors that don't have smaller groups within them. We offer a opportunity for them to offer, other than alternative to OEM, service and support to their customers, and have a little bit of arm's distance from their OEM partners, like let's say Cisco and Dell and HP, these big guys, right? We offer a third-party support to be able to support that hardware further on down the road, right? Legacy gear. So we call it extension of life, or, again, supporting of legacy equipment.
And when you go to the website, which is zpiaom.com, you'll learn more about Zeppel Productions or ZPI. This whole IT space is interesting, and how you get help the smaller businesses, not the biggest businesses in the world, get that IT support that we all need nowadays. It's imperative, and we need the latest and greatest at the best cost possible. Why was it important, after you started the business, you've been at this a while, to become a veteran-owned certified company?
You know, so it's funny. So I worked, luckily, when I got out of the Army, I was 26 when I went to work for a company called Ingram Micro. Ingram Micro is the world's largest IT distributor, or they were at one point. I think another couple of guys have merged. But anyway, still a $50 billion global gigantic company, and I got to go work for them. And they support, they're kind of the biggest unknown company out there, right? They support every reseller in the world. So a reseller would be companies that you may be familiar with, like CDW or SHI or Insight on the IT, pure IT play. But even guys like Best Buy and Staples and any of those retail guys as well, right? They're actually shipping only IT products for the reseller that we know and we partner with. So working with distribution, I wanted to break out and start my own company, have my own brand, offering alternative to OEM product, right? Just ways to save money. So a lot of things are private labeled these days, and I'm able to source product from the exact same contract manufacturer as the big names that we mentioned before, with my name on it at a huge discount, hardware and support, right? So because we do that, we offer that through a sales channel, I thought it'd be important for me to be able to let my other partners utilize my certifications as well, right? So we're minority-owned, veteran-owned, SBA 8A certified on the Texas DIR contract, but I don't sell to end users. So those certifications really didn't help me out very much. But bigger partners, and again, like CDW or Insight, these big resellers that have been around for 40 years, they don't have any diversity status, and their enterprise customers are asking for diversity spend. Well, how can they do that if they're not? They need to partner with guys like me. So when they partner with me, now their end user gets to retire tier two spend, and the reseller gets to retire tier one spend. And some of these partners like Dell and CDW are actually part of the $1 billion roundtable, who takes supplier diversity very seriously. And, we built a really cool solution and some really cool software around letting partners use my software, and I do lifecycle management for them, and they get to share diversity spend with me, even if they're not diverse partners.
And NVBDC.org is sort of the leading certification entity nationwide for veterans. It's a rigorous certification. You really have to prove yourself up, and you've done that, and in fact, you're actually on their board of advisors. I guess they're so impressed with you and you're so impressed with them. Mm-hmm. Tell us what does impress you about NVBDC.
Well, like you said, you know, their certification process. There's a few other companies out there, not NGOs, they call them, non-governmental organizations, that offer certifications for every other than just veteran as well, right? It could be minority, right? But there's only several that are recognized by the Billion Dollar Roundtable. And the Billion Dollar Roundtable is where the Fortune 500 companies are all members of the BDR. And that's the certifications they accept are NVBDC for veteran, WeBank for women, and NMSDC. Even though there's other ones out there, these are the three. And the reason the BDR chose them is because of that stringent process to get certified, right?
One of the things that we've seen with NVBDC is its ability to, I think I always use the network and I get corrected, it's really not networking, but sort of networking between the veteran businesses and guys on the the Billion Dollar Roundtable of putting folks together. It's more of a matchmaker than maybe networking. But have you experienced that sort of value from NVBDC?
Yeah, I was actually just in Louisville for their annual show, and absolutely, right? You've got the biggest names out there. Dell and gigantic logos are there, and the people from their supplier diversity groups are there, and they're speaking at the event and talking to veterans and explaining to them, how do you do business with companies our size? You realize that most veteran-owned businesses are small businesses, right? We're all small businesses. So how do you work with Apple? It's pretty hard to get into Apple, right? But if you got that NVBDC logo in there, it opens the door for you at least, right? It gives you the conversations, and you know they can help you navigate a little bit easier than doing it on your own, right? It's not very easy to open those doors these days.
So do you get asked by other veteran-owned businesses, hey, is it worth going through this process? And if so, what would you tell them?
You know, like you said, I'm on the board of advisors, and like I just said, it's not easy to open doors at companies like Dell and Apple and Disney and these gigantic companies, right? So you need to have everything you can possibly do to get your foot in the door. And because these gigantic logos are members of the BDR, it incents them. They have these goals that they put on themselves, by the way, right? They're not like the government where they've got these government mandated goals for supplier diversity. These are things that they put on themselves. So it only makes sense for them to back their investment, if you will, right? So, you know, I let everybody know that, yeah, if you're a veteran owned company, join the NVBDC. You'll work the system and you'll get business out of it.
All right. That was Jim Falzone talking with Scott Lopez and talking about NVBDC. So if you are a veteran-owned business and you want to learn what you need to do, contact these people. That's nvbdc.org. Next week on our program, we're going to be doing our benefits program. So if you have any questions that you want to put to our group, let me know. It's dale@veteransradio.org. We're going to go out with a song by Toby Keith today, and that's because Toby passed away on February 5th at only 62 years old. It says during his career, which spanned three decades, he sold over 40 million records thanks to his patriotic hits like Should Have Been a Cowboy, Made in America, and of course, courtesy of Red, White, and Blue. Pro-military stance wasn't just fodder for songs. He went through 11 USO tours to visit and play for the troops overseas. So we're going to say thank you very much, Toby Keith. We're going to miss you, your true patriot. And I think that for our audience, we want to let them know that these songs is really for them. And this is what he did for us here in America during our time of terrible times. So you're listening to Veterans Radio. We'll see you next week. You're dismissed.
My daddy served in the Army. We lost his right eye, but he flew a flag out in our yard. Till the day that he died, he wanted my mother, my brother, my sister, and me to grow up and live happy in the land of the free. Now this nation that I love is falling under attack. A mighty sucker punch came flying in from somewhere in the back. Soon as we could see clearly through our big black eye, man, we lit up your world like the 4th of July. Hey, Uncle Sam, put your name at the top of his list, and the Statue of Liberty started shaking her fist, and the eagle will fly, and it's gonna be here when you hear Mother Freedom start ringing her bell.
brought to you courtesy of the red, white, and blue. This big dog will fight when you rattle his cage. And you'll be sorry that you mess with the U.S. of A. 'Cause we'll put a boot in your ass, it's the American way. Hey, Uncle Sam, put your name at the top of his list. And the Statue of Liberty started shaking her fist. And the eagle will fly. And it's gonna be hell when you hear Mother Freedom start ringing her bell. And it'll feel like the whole wide world is raining down on you. I brought to you courtesy of the red, white.